Right, well, today I'm going to do something rather different. I'm just going to hopefully do this all in one talk. But I want to speak on something that's very timely at the moment and has been since March, and that is the whole subject of coronavirus or COVID-19. I'm giving this talk on the 23rd of August, 2020, just so that it can be placed in its time and in its context. And what I want to try and do is give an overall biblical view of what is going on and what's this all about and what is happening, why is it happening, what should we do about it, what should we think about it, how should we respond to it, how does it fit in with the wider prophetic picture of the end times, and does it fit in, has it anything to do with that, what's it about? Now, I'm not going to attempt to be exhaustive or comprehensive about this. I'm not going to try to be scientific or give lots of statistics and data and so on, because there isn't the time for that, and that's not my purpose. So it's my aim is to give my general perspective of the overall COVID hysteria from a biblical perspective as far as I can. And if you want to know more data and facts and figures and so forth, I suggest you follow me on Twitter and or Facebook, and that you get some of it from there, because I do quite frequently say things on there as well. Alright, well, when the coronavirus story first began in late March, I think it was around about the 23rd of March it really broke, my immediate instinctive response at that time was to say, this is a huge overreaction. It's a sledgehammer to crack a nut. It's a very small thing being handled in such a hysterical way. And that was my immediate thought. But then people like Boris Johnson and others came on the television and pleaded with us to take the deadly virus seriously. And I thought to myself, well, they must know something that I don't know. I mean, why would they be saying these things if they didn't know something? So from that point on, for a while, I washed my hands with the best of them. I kept my distance from people. I stayed at home, stayed in the garden. And a couple of weeks went by. Nothing happened. And then I carried on, and another couple of weeks went by and nothing happened. So we're now sort of in April, late April, and I was by this stage starting to think, what on earth is all this about? We're supposed to be panicking over this deadly virus. We were told at the beginning that we expect 500,000 people to die, and that it would affect people of all ages and perfectly fit people. We saw these videos at the beginning of people falling down dead in the street in China, bleeding out of their faces and all this. And that's not happening. Nothing's happening. We didn't know anybody who had COVID. We didn't know anybody who knew anybody who had it. We didn't know anybody who knew anybody who knew anybody that had it. You know, it was one of these sort of mythical things that's happening to somebody somewhere, but never to anybody that we knew or anybody that we spoke to, or in any way, nothing direct, nothing immediate. So I began, as I say, to wonder, what is this about? And I began to change my view back to what it was immediately at the beginning. I think I sussed it correctly at the beginning. It was a massive overreaction, a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Now, at the start, in the late March, they were assuring us that they were only asking us to go into lockdown for a very short time, and just to help the National Health Service to spread the peak of the infection over a longer period, to flatten the curve and give more time to build more ventilators and so on. The phrase used was 15 days to save the NHS. So if we can just stay in our gardens and in our houses for 15 days, that would be a big help. But interestingly, at that time, they were very much speaking in terms of, we're all going to have to get it, everybody will get it because it's highly infectious, and our objective is that we should achieve herd immunity. That's the technical expression, I think, for when you get more than 60% or so of people have got it, you start to get immunity, because people can't catch it from anyone because the people they're with have already got it, already had it. The aim was to achieve herd immunity, but just to slow down the progression of the disease in the early days. That was the objective. That's how it started. But as you'll know, it radically changed. And having driven that little, that jemmy in to wedge open the door or window, they then began to seek more and more and more. So this period of time to save the NHS, it just went on and on and on, and they demanded more and more and more, and the rules became more and more strict, more and more comprehensive, more and more piercing into every part of life. And we reached a stage where the government had assumed totally unprecedented powers to control and direct every aspect of our lives, down to the smallest detail, where we go, whom we see, what we do, whether we can go to work, whether we can see our families, whether we can go to church, whether we can go for a walk, whether we can sit on a park bench. People were literally reporting their neighbours to the police because they had seen their neighbour going out for a second walk with the dog later in the day. And this is the extent of the sort of East German style reporting of people to the Stasi, that we were reaching this in the UK. And the police even said in the end, they were getting so many people reporting their neighbours, they said, please stop reporting your neighbours, we can't keep up with the reports, you know, we can't do it. There's so many people were doing that. But they also closed down all the churches and even banned worship. Later on, they when they permitted some people to meet, they said, but you can't sing. You can't worship in church or as a church. Now, as I say, this is historically unprecedented. This has never happened in the 21st or 20th century or in any century from the 1st century onwards or 3,000, 4,000 years before that. This has never happened. Not even Nebuchadnezzar. Not even, you know, these people used to go around telling you whether you could go in your garden, whether you could see your mum or you see your dad or go and see your granny. Nobody has ever done this. It's unprecedented. And I have a sense of history that's reasonably advanced and reasonably good. But I remember there was much complaint in May 1940 when Churchill brought in an Emergency Powers Act, giving the government of that time all sorts of powers to do things, compulsory purchase. They could take your home and use it as an army base, or they could take your school and turn it into a headquarters for some military base, or they could just do what they wanted, take your farm and turn it into an RAF base. Of course they paid you for your things when they took them off you, but they were given powers of that nature. And even at that time, MPs were complaining that, notwithstanding that we faced the threat of invasion by the Germans, that this was an overreaction and it was an excessive loss of civil liberties and freedoms. Okay, now, I say that to put this in context, because what the government did in May 1940 is nowhere near as invasive, intrusive and extreme as what they have done in 2020. It was small beer compared to this. Nowhere did the government of that day tell people where they could go, who they could see, what time of day they had to be in or out, whether they could sit on a park bench, whether they could go for a walk with the dog, whether they could sunbathe, and so on. No, none of that was ever said. Neither has it ever been said for any disease that's ever happened, ever, in this country or anywhere. As I say, it's totally unprecedented. So I think that then entitles us to say, well, this is rather unusual. We need to think about this from a Christian perspective. What is going on? Why is this totally unprecedented level of intrusion happening? And what does it signify? What should we do about it? And you may have noticed for yourself that we are surrounded by people who are utterly terrified, brainwashed, like members of a cult. They are so convinced about the terrible dangers of COVID. They know that this is a terrible disease and that it's lurking everywhere they go. Everyone they meet is a source of infection. Everywhere they go, every door handle, everything is a source of infection that will bring deadly disease upon them. And they're terrified. Not everybody, I grant you, not everybody. Some people have enough common sense to realise it's nonsense. But a lot, an awful lot of people have fallen for this hook, line and sinker and are absolutely terrified. And I shall return to that, but it reminds me of, you know, if you ever watched any of these old 1950s science fiction films where aliens have landed down at the creek and taken over people in the town, and the people are wandering about with these glazed looks on their faces, and they've been taken over by the aliens, and even the sheriff's now been taken over by the aliens, and this is what's happening in the films. And it reminds me of that. People are going around with these glazed looks where they are utterly, utterly brainwashed. And I shall return to this subject of fear again shortly, but what are we to make of all this? What does it mean? Why is it happening? And what should our response be? And does this thing that's happening, does it have end time significance? What I mean is, does it link into prophecies in the Bible about the events that lead up to the arrival of the Antichrist and the tribulation and the events which precede the return of Jesus Christ to judge and rule the world? Does it have significance for that? So I'm going to look at a number of issues and points in no particular order, because I'm ranging far and wide over this, but we shall look at a number of issues and try to consider them in that manner. So let me begin again by emphasizing that the things which are happening now are completely unprecedented in world history. There's no parallel. We can't go back to the 19th, 20th, 18th, 17th century and say, oh yes, well we dealt with it then and this is how we came out of it. We have never done this. No country has ever done this. And that puts it, I think, in context. And I want us to see it in context. Otherwise we might just think this is a perfectly normal response in a normal way that we've done many times. We have not. Don't let anybody tell you that we've done this many times. We have not. So, what we're seeing then is our government is doing weird things, really weird things that it's never done before. Note, almost all governments are doing weird things in exactly the same way. They're doing it at exactly the same time. And they're doing it regardless of what nation it is, whether it has, and regardless of whether its government is left-wing or right-wing, whether it is a democracy or a dictatorship or whatever it is, which continent it's on. Governments are all doing pretty much the same thing in the same way at the same time. And so I think this causes me to begin even by making this conclusion. This could not be happening in this coordinated and choreographed and absolutely identical manner if we did not already have a one world government operating now, or at least the prelude to it, the fledgling form thereof, some kind of one world government arrangement already in place, already functioning. Why do I say that? Because you cannot coordinate the governments of the world and get them all to sing the same hymn off the same page at the same time without somebody coordinating it. And when you say that, people then start to mock you and say, well, you're some kind of conspiracy theorist. You obviously wrap silver paper around your head and tin foil and you're out there twitching and looking for aliens to land and so forth. There is no silver paper around my head. I'm not twitching and I'm not looking for aliens to land. The coordination, the choreographing, the controlling that is happening, I don't think is primarily happening at a human level. What I mean is, I don't believe that there is a man or two men or 10 men that are doing this. I believe this is ultimately and primarily operating at a demonic level. So there are principalities and powers. There are high-level demons ruling over every nation on this earth, and there are higher-level demons ruling over them, and there is Satan ruling over them. And they are operating in a coordinated manner, and their intentions, their policies, their what they want to happen is then being caused to happen through the governments that they control. So all governments, all nations have high-level demons ruling over them, influencing them to one degree or another. And at this time, we're seeing a level of coordination that I think we've never seen before. Okay. So, what do I mean by one world government? Well, what I'm referring to is to the fact that when the Antichrist comes, and the Antichrist will be a man who is inhabited by Satan, who's Satan enters into him, just as he entered into Judas. Satan will enter into him, and he will rule over the whole world and be given all of Satan's power. Now remember, of course, that Satan already rules over the whole world. Satan is the god of this world, the ruler of this world. He already has that authority. Of course, that authority is going to be taken away from him, but it hasn't been taken away from him yet. So Satan at this point is the ruler of this world, and he can give his power to whomever he wants. He can give power to Bill Gates or George Soros. He can give power to Adolf Hitler. He can give power to Joseph Stalin. He can give power to whoever he wants. Mark Zuckerberg. He can give power to Jack Dorsey. He can build up whoever he wants. And he does. And what else has Satan been doing? Well, one of the very targeted and very tactically astute things he's been doing is taking control of the world's media. Now, are you aware that six men basically own the entire media of the world? It's all held in a tiny number of hands. Have you ever noticed the complete or virtually complete uniformity of message in the media? Doesn't matter whether you watch the television, listen to the radio, read newspapers, read magazines. It doesn't matter where you go or what you watch or what you listen to. They are all saying the same. They are all promoting the COVID hysteria. They are all promoting Black Lives Matter, another hysteria. They're all stoking up racism where none existed. They're building up hatred of races, which I just interject as an aside, is another preliminary step which comes before the return of Jesus. What do I mean? That Jesus says that nation will rise against nation, but the original Greek says ethnos will rise against ethnos. And what that means is racial group will rise against racial group. Do you see? Not primarily nations. It's not Belgium versus Holland. It's racial group versus racial group. What's the significance of that? It's this, that is one of the birth pangs. When a woman's about to give birth, she starts to have these contractions that happen more powerfully and more frequently and closer together as the birth approaches. So what are we having simultaneously, just at the moment? Unprecedented levels of racial tension throughout the world, simultaneously with the control of the world's media, simultaneously with this hysteria about this disease, and the uniform actions and policies of governments all over the world. Now these, I think, come in the train of other birth pangs, like World War I and World War II, and the recreation of Israel and the winning back of Jerusalem and other things that have also happened, the arrival of the internet. Each of these things I would call birth pangs, and they're happening faster and faster. The great increase in the number and power of earthquakes. There are far more earthquakes now than there were in the 20th century, and there are far more in the 20th century than there were in the 19th. They're getting more frequent, more powerful, and so on. So this is the general background that we're looking at. And when we speak of one world government, therefore, we're speaking of Satan giving to the Antichrist the power to rule over the world. So what I'm looking at, therefore, is do the events we're speaking of and now experiencing, living through, have any relevance to that? Are they linked to that? Is it the beginnings of that? Is it part of that? Is it the prelude to that? That's what I want to look at. But don't make the mistake when we think of one world government, even that, even when the Antichrist has come, don't make the mistake of thinking that for that to occur, there must be 100% submission, 100% cooperation by all people everywhere in every country. That's not the case, not even when Antichrist comes. When Antichrist comes, and he will, and when he rules the world, and he will, When that happens, even then, there will still be individuals resisting him. And if I'm around, I want to be one of them. We might say, well, perhaps we won't be around, perhaps we'll have been raptured before then. I don't want to get into all that, but some people think we will be raptured, taken away before the tribulation. Other people think we'll be taken away during it. Other people think we won't be taken away. We will live through the tribulation. Let's leave that to one side. We'll discuss that some other time. But the point is that the tribulation is coming for somebody, quite possibly for us, and therefore somebody has got to get ready for it, and quite possibly we have got to get ready for it. So the existence of pockets of resistance by individuals and by groups doesn't mean that you can't have a one world government. The one world government will rule, but it won't have the 100% support of everybody on the earth. It'll just have a very high proportion of support, mostly through fear, but not 100%. So let's look at another issue that's happening at the moment as well, which I think again has end time significance, and that is the arrival of what you might call a cashless society. Now, Visa and MasterCard have more or less obtained a monopoly, or a duopoly you could say, over financial transactions. People are using cards more and more and more, and when they do, they're just using now just basically two companies. And they have almost complete control. The only exception to that is that diminishing number of people who use cash. And that is going down and down and down. And in recent years, you now have people using contactless and just tapping with their card or even their phone against a terminal and paying for things off their phone. Many younger people today don't go about with any cash. They just wander about with no cash in their pocket at all. They rely totally on their phone to do everything. We don't. Those of us who are a bit older don't do that. I always walk around with cash in my pocket. But the problem is that many, many shops are now refusing cash. And the COVID hysteria is being used as a pretext for that. And they're saying, look, you know, if we hand over cash and handle cash, that gives a risk of infection. So let's think of others. Let's not use cash. And many shops are refusing to take cash. And even from elderly people, I know one chain of bakeries that refused to let a 92-year-old woman buy a loaf of bread with cash. They insist that they must use cards. People don't have a card, don't know how to use a card. But also, a strange thing is happening. Many, many shops are reporting they don't have any coins. Somebody is removing the coins from circulation, making it more difficult to use cash because you don't have coins, you can't give change. Somebody is organising that, taking out the coins, so it's harder and harder to use cash. And now, what's the significance of that? Firstly, I think if it is happening, and if this is part of what's coming, there's going to be under the Antichrist effectively a cashless society, where nobody can buy or sell without having the mark of the beast. And if we don't have the mark of the beast, you won't be allowed to buy and sell. Now, people have often wondered and pondered, what is the mark of the beast? Well, it's a mark on your hand or your forehead that authorizes you, it validates you, it permits you to buy and sell and so forth. But if you take the mark of the beast, you cannot be saved. You will be lost. You go to hell forever and to the lake of fire. But if you don't take the mark of the beast, you'll be persecuted by the Antichrist. So it's a most unpleasant prospect. But there is an aspect to this which pertains to cash. And if you're taking away cash, as they are now doing, what are they saying that you must do? Well, that you must use cards. Well, what's the significance of that? You might say, gosh, you're terribly argumentative and sort of awkward customer. Why don't you just use cards like these people want you to do and use cards all the time? Well, because if you use cards all the time and there is no cash, you are completely known about. You are completely monitored and controlled at all times. They know exactly where you are. They know exactly what you're buying, who you're doing business with, who you're relating to. They can find out everything they want to know about you through your transaction history. And moreover, they know where you are with your phone. They know where you are with your spending. They know far too much about you. Now, cash offers you the chance to fly under the radar and not to be controlled to the same degree. They know that. They're very well aware of it, which is why they don't want you to use cash. So I think the advent of this cashless society, which we're now rapidly seeing come upon us, which you might have, even a short time ago, you'd have said, that can't happen, that wouldn't happen, that would never happen, that just couldn't happen. It's happening in front of us. And not everywhere, I grant you, but between March and August, would you agree that we have seen astonishing changes take place in the powers that governments have taken unto themselves, the degree to which individuals have allowed themselves to be totally coordinated, controlled and bossed about and told what they can and can't do? You couldn't have believed it. Could you have believed last year, in 2019, that we would seek permission from the government to go out for a walk with the dog? We want to know whether the Prime Minister thinks we can walk the dog. How far can we walk the dog? How long does Boris want us to walk the dog for? Well, he says we can walk the dog for up to an hour, and we cannot go more than 5 miles from our house, and we cannot sit on a park bench, and we cannot go in even in our own garden and sunbathe. I mean, I'm just giving a few examples of the minutiae of detail that they went into about what you can and can't do. Now, you would not have believed last year, if someone had stood up and said, you know what's going to happen in 2020? We're all going to become people from a 1950s science fiction film. We're all going to be brainwashed and crazy. And you just say, no, don't be ridiculous. That's not going to happen. The government is going to tell you whether you can walk your dog, whether you can sit on a park bench, whether you can go to work, whether you can sing, whether you can go in church, whether you can visit your granny, whether you can go and see your dying relatives. The government will tell you what you can do. You'd say, no, don't be ridiculous. You're being hysterical. That's never going to happen. Not in this country. Well, it happened, and it happened with astonishing speed. Yes. Within about 3 or 4 weeks, the majority of people in this country had completely accepted total control over their lives. And I just was astonished by the lack of resistance. You know, you look, say, to the arrival of the Germans in Paris, in France in 1940. The overwhelming majority of the French population just accepted it and didn't resist. A tiny, tiny, tiny number joined the resistance. And now it's all blown up as if everybody was in the resistance. But a tiny, tiny fraction resisted the Germans. And only a small number are resisting this. Now. Okay. So even if this is not the beginning of what we might call the tribulation, as foretold in Revelation and elsewhere, one thing I think we can say is that this is a dummy run for the tribulation. And the tyranny and the control freakery that's now happening is, you could turn it round into a positive. It's your chance to practice, to learn, to develop the skill of showing courage, of saying no, of standing alone, of being the odd one out, and of taking abuse and hostility and criticism. Now, we need to learn how to engage in civil disobedience, not in an aggressive way, but in a bold and courageous way. We need to say no. We're not doing it. I have not worn masks in shops. I mean, can you believe it? I'm supposed to wear a mask going in a shop. I'm supposed to wear masks going pretty much everywhere. I don't want to. I'm not going to. There is no benefit to it. It's ridiculous. And I'll come to that shortly, but I'm not going to. So I'm saying no to that, you see. And I think that, in a certain sense, is giving us the opportunity to practice saying no. Now, what will we need to say no to in the future? We'll need to say no to the mark of the beast. We'll need to say no to worshipping the Satan and listening to the words of the false prophet and doing as they say. We'll need to say no to a lot of things. And if we don't practice now saying no to these relatively, relatively minor instructions and prohibitions, how are we going to say no to that? If you can't say no to wearing a mask, how are you going to say no to the mark? This is your time, your chance to practice, to see what's coming and to practice growing your courage. And I say that because my experience is that most people have very little courage. Most people are ruled by fear. They give in to their fear. They don't stand up to their fear. And they don't. It doesn't even occur to them that they should stand up to their fear. So let's look at this. The role and significance of fear and the part that it plays in control and manipulation. Now, have you noticed, as I said, how terrified some people are? I was recently out in an outdoor shopping area. It wasn't even inside buildings. We were outside in a sort of shopping area, uncovered. And I was standing, looking at my phone, about 8 feet away from the ladies' toilets. My wife had gone in and I was just standing with my back to the toilets, on my phone, facing away. And then this woman came along, in her sort of 50s or so, and she asked me if I was using the phone or something that was the telephone, you know, something there. And I said, no, I'm just standing here. And she wouldn't go by me. And I thought, no, I'm not waiting, I'm not using anything. And then it dawned on me. And I said, oh, are you afraid to walk by me? And she said, and then her daughter said, yes, she's afraid, like this. And I thought, oh, all right. Now, this was a woman who was afraid to walk by me, even though I had my back to her and I was standing several feet away. She wanted me to stand even further away. And I saw the fear in her face. She was terrified of walking past somebody. Now, I know I'm not very nice looking, I realise that. But the point is, someone was scared to walk past me several feet away and wanted me to move even more feet away so that she could walk past me. And I thought, am I living in some kind of insane asylum or something? What's going on? And this is all happening with breathtaking speed. Okay. Now, have you noticed that people, so many of them, are willing to believe everything they're told, without question, instantly. And they feel in terrible danger. It's all totally real to them. But what does God think about fear? Because you might say, well, so what? Everyone's right and proper to be afraid. Perfectly sensible to be afraid all the time. Well, what does God say? Does he agree with that? Do you think he wants us to be afraid? Well, the answer is no. Now, why do I say that? Because he's told us 366 times not to be afraid. Now, I think that adds up to what you might call a powerful argument, don't you? If he's told us 366 times not to be afraid, could it be that God wants us not to be afraid? I think possibly. Now, why then is the government basing everything on whipping up fear instead of calming us down? In World War II, they didn't try to whip up fear in the population. They tried to whip up courage. They tried to whip up confidence. They tried to whip up calm. You see, it was quite the opposite of what we're doing now. And even when the invasion was imminent and possible, Churchill gave orders that if the invasion happens, if the parachutists come, this order was to go out, you can take one of them with you. So every man and woman in this country was going to be given orders, even if you die, take one of them with you. Attack a parachutist. Go for him with a machete. Go for him with a kitchen knife. Try and get one of them. Now, this was the order that was going to be given, do you see? What was he trying to do? To instill courage and confidence. You see, not to instill fear. He wanted us not to be afraid. What are our government doing? They want us to be afraid. They are deliberately whipping it up. And the media too. You might say, well, the media is not part of the government. But I think it is part of the one world government. They are singing out the same hymn book. The government and the media are selling the same message. Be afraid. Be very afraid. That's what they're trying to say. And why are they doing it? Because fear is an excellent way to control and manipulate people. And they will say that people will obey anyone and obey anything when they reach the necessary level of panic and hysteria. So firstly, fear itself is wrong. God tells us not to be afraid. And if we are afraid or must be afraid, then he tells us to be courageous. What does that mean? To do the thing you're afraid of. To go ahead anyway. To do it anyway. So firstly, God says don't be afraid. But then he says, but if you are afraid, do it anyway. That's what courage is. Doing it anyway. But secondly, the point is that using fear to control others is also wrong. It's even more wrong. So being afraid is wrong, but somebody using your fear to control you is very wrong. And thirdly, it tells you something about the people who do that. If they are using fear to control you, it tells you something about them. Because we started this by saying, what does it mean? What are we to take from this? In what way are we to use our discernment to understand what's happening? Well, I would say this. You look at a government and at those around them, at the media, who want you afraid, and you have to say, well, fear is wrong, God says so. Using fear to control people is wrong. Clearly wrong. Well, then they are acting wrongly. You can deduce that from those very simple facts. And I think it's right that you should. And therefore, having deduced that it's wrong to be afraid and it's wrong to use fear to control us, we should resist them. We should say, these people do not have my interests at heart. They are not acting legitimately. They are acting wrongly, and I will resist them. Because the fourth point is, we are not meant to be controlled. It's a very important point to God. He does not want to control everybody. Now, some people think wrongly that God controls everything. It's an aspect in many ways of Islam. It's an aspect in some ways of Calvinism. The idea that God controls everything and everybody. He controls everything. He controls whether you make a typing error when you're typing. God made you make it. God did it. No, he doesn't. God doesn't want to control you. He doesn't want to make you repent. He's not willing to make you believe in him. He wants you to willingly choose to obey him. And it's a very important principle that God works by. He wants there to be freedom. Okay. Freedom of choice. Freedom to serve him. Freedom to not serve him. Freedom to love him. Freedom to not love him. Freedom to obey him. Freedom to not obey him. And therefore, the use of control and manipulation is a very, very bad thing and tells you a lot about those who do it. Now, knowing that, I think, will help you with your discernment. Because you'll say, well, if I know that, and if I know these people are doing that, that tells me something about them. Now, once you've made that connection, you're better informed and you're in a better place to know whether you should obey everything they say. But also, let's look at this. What about the role and significance of deception? It's not just fear and control, but also deception. What about that? Because not only are the government and others, police, media, and other, the NHS and other people, not only are they seeking to control us through fear, they're also lying to us, and they're doing it systematically. You may have noticed that they constantly change their advice and they contradict themselves and what they said previously. They lie to us about the severity of the virus, the number of deaths, how infectious it is, how many infections have occurred. They're lying to us about this. In fact, it's no longer even seriously disputed that they were exaggerating and have been exaggerating the death figures from the beginning. They were putting COVID on death certificates when there was little or no reason to do so. They were doing it even when it was categorically obvious the person did not die of COVID. Now, the definition of what goes on a death certificate for COVID, it's so broad, it's more or less, it covers everybody. It's everybody who, in the last 28 days, tested positive for COVID in any way. No matter what they die of, it's assumed that, so you could be run over by a bus 27 days later, and it's assumed you died of COVID. But it's not only that, because even people who tested negative or who were never tested at all, it's assumed they must have probably caught COVID. Do you see? Now, this is nothing other than deception. It's just blatant falsification of the figures and the data. And you have to ask yourself, why are they doing that? And what should I think of people who blatantly, systematically falsify data? I can give you an example within my own personal knowledge. There's someone I know, and this is a very typical story, and I've heard a very similar story told many times online. But here's my story. This man that I know, from not in my family, but within a family relative of in-laws of mine, he's 84 years old, and he died of asbestosis that he'd had for many years. And 2 days before he died, he was tested for COVID, and it came back negative. He died 2 days later of asbestosis, which is a cancer formed caused by asbestos. And guess what they put on his death certificate? COVID. All right? And the family disputed it and queried it, and they said that the doctor insisted that that stay on the death certificate. And he said, I realise he tested negative 2 days before, but maybe he caught it in the next 2 days and died of it. Now, maybe a Martian came into his hospital bed and attacked him. You can't rule it out. And so, but if we were to say, therefore he was killed by a Martian, wouldn't that be about the same? How can you conclude that something did happen because it might have happened? I mean, this is the level of absurdity, but it goes beyond absurdity. It's dishonest. The doctor saying that knew that he was lying. Now you might say, well, doctors wouldn't lie. They have no reason to. They have a very good reason to. Money has been promised to every hospital department that records deaths for COVID. So if you record that Mr. Joe Brown or Mr. Fred Bloggs died of COVID, your department will receive maybe £20,000 for every death. It's absolutely in their financial interest to do it. And if they put somebody on a ventilator, I think they get £39,000. So they're dead keen to put people on ventilators if they can, because they get money for doing it. So there is a direct causal connection between diagnosing COVID, putting it on a death certificate, and receiving money. Do you see? Now, this is outrageous. And it's not even denied. You might think, oh, you're just saying that, and that's just your surmising. You're just guessing that's probably happening. I'm not guessing anything. That is what's happening, and it's openly the case. That is what's happening. And so doctors in hospitals are being told, call it COVID all the time. Some doctors have tried to blow the whistle on this, and they've secretly, without giving their names, have gone online saying, we've been told to call everything COVID. Do you see? It's known, but very few, there are some who've said it openly, but very few, because if you say it openly, you'll be sacked. So doctors are towing the line. They are being intimidated. Nurses are being intimidated. And the honest ones, and there aren't many, but the honest ones feel very uncomfortable about it. Okay. So in any other context, that would be treated as fraud and they'd go to prison. But in this context, the fraud is completely acceptable. There's no problem. You can say that without any comeback. So I think now, in the light of what we've seen over 5 months, anybody with any common sense can now see that COVID is not dangerous to anyone who is not already either dying of something else or with a very severe illness or extremely elderly and with a seriously compromised immune system. It's not dangerous to anybody who's not in those groups. Well, of course, if you say that, then everything is dangerous to people in those groups, isn't it? Catching a cold is dangerous to people in those groups. Cutting their finger is dangerous to anyone. Anything is dangerous to anyone in those groups. That doesn't mean that COVID is dangerous. It means for that tiny number of people, anything is dangerous, including COVID. Okay? The other thing I think that's obvious to anybody is that most people don't get it at all. Or even if they do get it, they have either zero or negligible symptoms. Now this is unarguably the case. They have to acknowledge it. The authorities acknowledge that the vast, vast majority of people who get COVID don't even know they've got it, because it's so mild, they don't even know. And so the only is COVID is one of those weird diseases where you have to go and have a test to know whether you've got it. It's not like whether you've broken your ankle. You don't think, I wonder if I've broken my ankle. You know, don't you? But with COVID, you can be competing in the Olympics and you discover you've got COVID by a test, which, by the way, also involves massive numbers of false positives. So many of the people who are tested for COVID and told they've got COVID have actually not got COVID, they've just got a cold. Because a cold is a coronavirus. There are lots of coronaviruses. And there are millions of types of cold and flu. That's the whole problem. They just mutate all the time. Well, if you have a cold and get tested, you'll probably come positive for COVID. Because the tests aren't specific enough. Do you see? Now, can you see how pointless the testing is? It doesn't mean anything. It's all just so unreliable and tells you so little. But all people who now get colds and flu are all deemed to have COVID. Have you noticed that COVID has cured all other diseases? Nobody gets colds, nobody gets flu, nobody gets a sore throat, nobody gets laryngitis now, nobody gets anything. All these diseases have all been completely wiped out by the arrival of COVID. So anybody who has the slightest sniffle is immediately, they know they've got COVID. We know. Do you see? Now, it's just so ridiculous. Anybody with any honesty, any common sense would say, that is plainly ridiculous. And to go along with this is foolishness. Now, we can be excused. I hope I can be excused for the first 3 to 4 weeks of saying, well, they must know something. I'll wash my hands. I'll stay away from people. I won't go in shops. But after a bit, you can't be excused. You can't be excused now for believing them. Because you've now seen enough data that you, with your own eyes and your own ears, can carry out enough empirical research by yourself in conjunction with your friends and relatives to say, this is baloney. This is rubbish. So, but what other ways were they being deceptive? Hospitals and GP surgeries and so on. Now, far from being frantically busy, they're doing little or nothing. We're told that our hospitals are overrun. And for a long time we were told, you know, don't go to see your doctor. Think about how devastatingly overworked he is. Stay away. You know, just try and treat yourself. Don't put pressure on those poor doctors and nurses who are suffering so much. They were doing next to nothing. Okay? The GP surgeries are basically closed. They make a few phone calls each day between sort of 9:30 and 11:30, and that's it. They don't do home visits unless it's exceptional. People aren't allowed to come to the surgery unless it's exceptional. I know one senior partner in a GP surgery. He's got so little to do. He had no patients and so little to do. Once he'd done, he caught up on all his old paperwork. He then started doing DIY jobs in the surgery to something to do. Now, okay, that's what he was doing. But I'm hearing that same story all over the place. You try getting into a GP surgery today. There's no GPs. There's nobody there to see you. They won't see you. And what are they doing? They're doing nothing. They're going shopping. They're knocking off early and going home. This is the truth of it. But what were we told? That they are totally run off their feet, overwhelmed, you see. They were building these called Nightingale hospitals in London and Birmingham and so on. 4,000 beds in the London one, they had 19 patients. Thousands of beds in the Birmingham Nightingale hospital. These are overflow hospitals built by the army. No patients. Nobody ever went in it. And then they built these special morgues for all the dead bodies. They've never been used. And online just the other day, a person who's in charge of the burials and cremations in a particular local authority area, he was told that they had to dig lots and lots of graves for all the rush of deaths that was going to happen. None of them have been used. So they've got all these graves dug ready for nobody. Nobody's dying. Do you see? And what I'm talking about here is deception. We're being lied to about the hospitals, about the GPs, about all this. We're being lied to. They're supposed to be overrun with busyness because of the deadly disease, but they are not. And I'm not relying only on my own eyes and ears. I'm relying on the eyes and ears of hundreds of people that I've asked about this online and in person. And they all say the same thing. And yet, for a long time, we were pressurized to go out on a Thursday night and clap the NHS. We're all standing on the street. We're all going to get saucepans. Clap, clap, clap. The heroes. Clap the heroes. I never went out. I refused to do it. But other people went out on the street clapping. And I said, no, I won't do it. And after a little while, it began to die down. People stopped doing it so much. Especially when so many people, not just one or two, but so many people in the NHS were taking the mickey out of us and showing their contempt for us. They were doing these dance videos and they were going on TikTok, and it was just like an epidemic of dance videos all around the NHS. Doctors, nurses, 20, 30, 40 of them, all dancing a conga, going along the corridors dancing. And you've seen the videos, and there weren't just one or two, there were hundreds of them. Now, how could they be doing that if they were run off their feet, desperately overworked with the massive numbers of deaths that we're dealing with? Do you see? My point is this. You're being lied to about it at every level. So, but why do all these lies matter? So what? What if we're being lied to? What does it tell us? How should we respond to those who are lying to us? Well, basically, it is our duty. We have been commanded to judge. You know how the Bible tells you not to judge? It also tells you to judge. It tells you not to judge in the sense of krites. That means to assume superiority, to take Jesus' role as the final judge of the universe, to judge everybody's value and worth as a Christian and whether they're any good or not. That we're not to do. But we are commanded to judge in the sense of diakrino, which is to assess the trustworthiness of people, whether they can be trusted, whether they are lying to us, whether their doctrines are correct, whether they're teaching falsehood or truth. That we are to judge all the time. Not only in the church, but everywhere we go. We're to judge what the government is saying, whether it matches the Bible. We're to judge what preachers are saying, whether it matches the Bible. We're to diakrino everywhere. Now, we are to diakrino what our government is telling us. We're to use our discernment and decide whether it's lies or not. And we're to use our discernment, or we're to develop some so that we can use it. And then we are to refuse to be lied to, refuse to be controlled, refuse to be manipulated. That's our role. Now, you might say, but the majority are going along with this. Now, surely all those people can't be wrong. But actually, in life, they can be, because the majority is nearly always wrong about just about everything. Not just with COVID, but with the gospel, the Bible, all sorts of things. Don't you agree that the majority is wrong on most things? The majority of people apparently believe in evolution. Well, that's wrong. The majority of people believe that they don't believe the Bible. Well, they're wrong. The majority of people don't think Jesus rose from the dead. Well, they're wrong. Do you see? The majority of people don't believe that salvation is through Jesus Christ alone. Well, they're wrong. So merely being in the majority doesn't make you right. And we've got to not think that it does. Now, this error on the part of the crowds around us, the crowd is nearly always wrong, but that error will only get worse as the end times approach. And I think the almost uniformity of error that you see around us, the widespread swallowing of this nonsense, to me has end time significance. Because I think the people of 1950 or 1850 or 1750, I don't think they'd have fallen for it. Not for long. But our generation is falling for it and remaining falling for it. To me, that propensity, that willingness, that tendency to accept deception and not to see it as a lie tells you something about the times we're living in, that we're living in the end times. I believe so. And you might say, well, surely our government wouldn't lie to us, and certainly our government wouldn't be so totally mistaken about such a huge issue. Well, why wouldn't they be? Remember, the same people that are pushing this hysteria about COVID are the same people who have done the following, who've brought us the following things or lied to us about the following things. They're the same people who brought us civil partnerships instead of marriage. They're the same people who brought us gay marriage. They're the same people that brought us gender confusion, that men can become women and women can become men. And you're a man if you think you are, you're a woman if you think you are, and you're a bigot if you don't agree. That they're the same people that are bringing us that. They're the same people that are carrying out and promoting and extending abortion. In simple words, the people who are telling us this, both in the government and in the hospitals, are killing children. Now what would you say? I've just been told by this man, he murders a lot of children, but anyway, he's told me to believe him and to listen to him. I mean, he does murder a lot of children, but I think he's a decent man. Would you say that? Now these people are killing children. And we think, we've forgotten that that matters. We've forgotten that that means anything. These people are covering up for Muslim rape gangs on a massive industrial scale. The government, the police, all the people that are involved in this thing about COVID are the same people that covered that up on a massive scale. They are the same people that are supporting an Islamic invasion into this country. They are watching boats land on our beaches with 30, 40 Muslim men in, who then walk onto the beach and they put them in a bus and take them to hotels and put them in 4-star hotels, and then they end up being given passports. And the population don't want that, but the government are doing it. They are the same people that are doing that. Many of them were pro-European Union. Almost all the civil servants, almost all the senior police, almost all the senior NHS staff are pro-EU. The EU is a wicked thing, but they're for it. Many, many, many of them promote or even engage in paedophilia. Now this is not just in America amongst the friends of Jeffrey Epstein and so forth. This is a widespread thing. Many, many people in senior positions in politics are paedophiles. And I believe that many of them are put into that position precisely because they're paedophiles. They're enticed into paedophilia and then put into high positions. Why? Because they can be controlled. Now, Ted Heath was a paedophile. He was Prime Minister of this country from 70 to 74. He took us into the European Union. He was an outright liar. He was a paedophile. I think he was put into that position because he was controllable. And it's far more the case today. There are many, many people who are paedophiles in high office. The Clintons are paedophiles. And there are many more. And what I mean is, these are the people telling us things. Okay, they're telling us things about COVID. So you might, coming back to the question, but surely they wouldn't lie to us. Surely they wouldn't be wrong. Well, they're wrong on all that, aren't they? They're lying about all that. So why wouldn't they be lying about COVID? Why would you imagine that they won't lie to us? But also consider this, because I'm wanting us to look at the judgment that we form of the nature, character and conduct of these people who are talking to us. Not only in the government, but in the NHS, in the police and so on. Consider the arbitrariness, the offhandness, the callousness of their decisions and their actions. Now, would a kind, gentle, honest, caring person do the following? And would they do it without a word of apology or regret or concern ever expressed by any of them? And I'm going to list you a number of things that they have done without any regret, without any concern, without any apology, without any racking of their consciences. These are the things they've done. They've made decisions on huge issues very rapidly, made in an afternoon. In one afternoon, our Chancellor of the Exchequer decided to put the whole nation on furlough, giving them 100% of their pay. That was more or less decided in an afternoon. And it never even dawned on them, never occurred to them, oh, I wonder if these people will actually develop quite a taste for being off work, being paid in full for sitting at home. And that's exactly what happened. People then don't want to go back to work. They want to stay at home being paid in full for not going to work. Now there are millions of people who have a vested interest in the hysteria carrying on. in particular school teachers, don't want to go back to work because they have a vested interest. Now, that was a catastrophically foolish decision made in such an indecent rush to make decisions. But that, secondly, and more importantly, they made a decision that we would have no contact with the lonely, the elderly, the sick, the demented with dementia, or the mentally troubled. We shall have no contact with them. Now, those people have all been effectively abandoned by our country, by our nation, and nobody's allowed to go and help them. You are forbidden to help them. You're forbidden to see the lonely. There might be an old lady on your street, terribly lonely, housebound. You can't go and see her. You can't go and comfort her. You can't go and have a chat with her twice a week, and so on, that many good neighbours would do. That's banned. Okay? That there is no contact with families. Can you consider the terrible loneliness that that causes for some people? It might be okay if you're living in a household of seven people and you've all got plenty of people to mix with, but what if you're a single person household? Elderly, housebound. Nobody can see you. Nobody can go and be with you. This was brought in at the drop of a hat, and they showed no concern for the loneliness, the dreadful loneliness that would produce, the isolation. They stopped people going to work. And that again caused a lot of isolation, especially for single people, and for many of whom the only chance they'd get to meet anybody is at work. Other than that, they live alone. There's a lot of people in that position. And what I'm getting at with each of these things, and there are more to come, is that the government did all this and it didn't bother them. The NHS aren't bothered. They're not bothered that these things are happening. They've banned all funerals from having just other than a handful there. Weddings, you can't have a wedding, you can't have a reception. If you do, you just have to get married and nobody comes to your wedding, nobody comes to your funeral. GP surgeries, as I say, have closed. Dentists have closed. Hospitals are virtually closed. Now, what about this? Are you aware that because these places are closed, there is a massive failure to diagnose and treat and test for cancer, heart disease, strokes? I mean, it's vitally important that a stroke should be caught within 4 hours and that treatment should be given inside 4 hours. That is not happening. So people are now getting strokes and they are not being treated. People are getting cancer and they are not being tested and they are not being treated. There's a 43% reduction in the number of referrals for breast cancer. That's just one cancer. Now, I think it's the same for all of them. What does that mean? Why am I going on about that? Because what I'm saying is that people who made these decisions, supposedly for our safety, have sentenced to death countless thousands of people with heart disease, strokes, cancers that are not going to be treated, not going to be diagnosed until it's too late. Have you ever heard anybody in the government or in the NHS express even a moment of regret about that? Have you ever heard any of them admit that it's happening or that it bothers them? I have not in the last 5 months. I know it's happening, it's manifestly happening, it cannot be denied that it's happening. But it doesn't bother them. Do you see? And I'm trying to say, what can we deduce from this about the people doing it to us? All right? What would you think of a group of people who just don't care? What about GPs who don't want to see patients? Hospitals who don't want to treat anybody? Even now, they just announced that in accident and emergency, you've got to make an appointment to go to accident and emergency. Isn't that something of a contradiction in terms? How can you make an appointment to have an emergency treatment? They're becoming more and more callous and indifferent to people suffering. Not only loneliness and abandonment and isolation, but cancer and heart disease. They just don't care. But compare this. I keep going back to World War II. Winston Churchill brought us into a conflict, okay, which produced the deaths of many people. And he was right to do it. It was needed. We went to war with the Germans and then the Luftwaffe attacked us and many people were bombed out in London. Now, consider the difference. In 1940, when the Blitz was on, he went out in his car to examine the bomb damage, and there were people on the sides of the street, their houses had been bombed out, and they were standing on the pavements, and Churchill came along in his car. He got out of his car to look at the bomb damage, and when he saw the poor, pathetic people standing in the street with no homes, the survivors who'd come back to their homes from the underground stations to see their homes destroyed, Churchill began to weep in the street. He was just so moved by their plight, and he was so moved by it. And the people said, look, he's weeping about us. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that that man was bothered about it. Now, how many doctors have you seen weeping about the untreated cancer patients? How many doctors have you seen weeping about elderly people isolated in their homes, terribly depressed? I know of one case, a dementia patient. It's a friend of my wife who has a mother who's in a nursing home. Now, she believes that her family have fallen out with her and abandoned her because they're not coming to visit her. And she's going through a lot of distress because she's not allowed to have visitors. Do you see? Now, how many times have you heard people in the government saying how terribly upset they are about that? It hops off them. They are not interested or bothered. That is, I think, a reasonable conclusion to come to, because that's what I see. That's what you hear. And even a very insensitive, uncaring person would think that those kind of sufferings and those kind of things matter, and they'd be concerned about it, but we are not seeing them being concerned about it. And they won't even admit that it's happening. They don't even want to mention it. They won't acknowledge it. They won't take the other deaths into account. So they falsify the number of COVID deaths, but according to what we hear, nobody is going to die unnecessarily of cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, or anything else. And that's just a fiction that is maintained, for which there's no basis. Plainly, they will. But it is not bothering them. So how can we trust people who act like that? Now, a biblical approach to COVID would be based on solid science, genuine science, not bogus, common sense and a sense of proportion, but above all, on compassion. Now, on the basis of what I've been speaking about, do you think that those are the three things that are guiding the government? Solid science, common sense, and compassion. I would say the opposite on all three. They are being guided by somebody telling them to do this. Okay? And I may come to that. The why. Why are they doing it? Because it's got nothing to do with our health. It's got nothing to do with our safety. They are doing it for a different reason. Alright, what about masks? Now, firstly, the whole thing about masks is totally unnecessary from a medical perspective. In fact, it's even harmful to wear masks. Now, how do we know that? I'll tell you how. Because that's what the government told us for the first 4 months of lockdown. Because some zealots were saying, let's all wear masks, you know. And the government was saying, no, there's no need. There's no scientific basis for that. There's no need for anyone to wear masks. But then they changed their mind. And now they want masks to be compulsory, and they are compulsory. But why did they do that? And I believe it was to condition us to accept yet more control. Things had to be done in stages. So the mask thing, if they brought the mask thing in on day one, perhaps we'd have rebelled. So they waited. I think the mask thing is to condition you to accept their control over you, and that it has no limits. Now, why do I refuse to do it? Why are masks wrong? I don't believe there's any reason to wear a mask. It isn't necessary, it isn't beneficial, in many ways it's harmful, but it also has many other disadvantages and many problems with it. Now, God gave us faces for a reason. We speak through our faces. You may not know it, but your face has more to say than your mouth does. People can read your face. They know what your mood is. They know what you're meaning. They know whether you're joking. They know whether you're serious. They know whether you're sad. They know whether you're frightened. They know whether you're friendly. They know whether you can be trusted through your face. God put faces on us for a reason. But another reason about the face, I don't know if you've ever considered this, the face is perhaps the most important part of the image of God that we've been made in. Now, God has a body like us. He looks like us. We look like him. But in his face, that's the most glorious part of him, and it's the most glorious part of us. And God has made us in his image. Our face matters. okay? But our face gives us dignity, and masks destroy that. Masks destroy human dignity. But all, above all, the mask is a powerful symbol of your acceptance of their total control over you. When you go about in shops in a mask, well, first of all, you're making the mistake of being afraid. Secondly, you're making the mistake of obeying tyrants who you should not obey. But thirdly, you're accepting someone's total control over you, and you should not. Don't accept their total control. Stand up and say, I'm made in the image of God, and God made me a human being in his image with infinite value, and I will not submit to you. Okay? Alright, then moving on. What about the vaccine? What about the COVID vaccine? I believe that you'd have to be insane to let them give you the COVID vaccine. Now, the man behind it, I'm going to have to speed up. The man behind it, and possibly I think the man behind COVID as well, is Bill Gates. He's the most prominent of them. A thoroughly wicked man in every way. Did you know that Bill Gates wants world population reduced to, not by, to 500 million. He wants there to be 500 million on the planet, not 7.5 billion, 500 million. In effect, he wants about 84% of us not to be here. He wants us to stop having children. He wants more of us to die, and so on. That's what he wants. That's what he's saying he wants. Okay. Now, would you? I wouldn't even buy a used car from him. Never mind buy a vaccine from him. But in the vaccine, I mean, just let me say this. I was just doing a calculation on this. He wants us reduced to 500 million. And I worked out the maths on it. That is 1/15. He wants 14/15 of us to die, and 1/15 of us to live. Do you know what the figure is? The percentage? 6.66. And when I saw that, I thought, goodness, is that a kind of clue, a hint? He wants us reduced to 6.66% of the population. I don't know whether that means anything, but it struck me as a little bit spooky when I saw that. But the other thing is, he wants microchips in the vaccine. You might think, well, a vaccine is purely a medical thing. It's the purpose of a vaccine is to enable you not to catch a disease. Well, then you need to catch up with the times. That used to be the purpose of a vaccine when you had your polio jab and all the rest. That's not the purpose now. Into a vaccine will go microchips, which enable you to be monitored and tracked everywhere you go. They will know where you are exactly. You might say, well, what's the problem? Because your phone, they can track your phone. Well, yes, but if you pluck up the determination, you can actually wrestle the phone out of your hand and put it somewhere, like Jack Bauer does on the telly, and they go tracking him, and they rush around the corner to get him, and they find his phone is in a litter bin. And you could actually put your phone down, couldn't you?
Yeah.
But they want you to have microchips, tiny, tiny little microchips inside you that tell them where you are. Now, am I missing something? Why on earth would you want to let these people do this to you? Why would you take a vaccine from a man who wants the population of the world to go down by 84%? But also, aborted babies are used to make the vaccine. That is just so wicked. And also, why have they obtained total immunity from litigation for negligence or physical damage caused to you? Why have they got that? Why do they need total immunity from litigation for the damage caused to you by the vaccines? Because they don't want you suing them for the damage caused by the vaccines. What does that tell you? But also, look at the vaccines that Bill Gates did, experimenting on vaccines in Africa. The only place you could get away with it. Giving vaccines to Africans caused terrible birth problems and terrible medical problems that came from Bill Gates' vaccine experiments in Africa. How much are you hearing about that on the media? You're not, are you?
No.
Now, they want to force you to have the vaccine. They want to make you do it. And if they can't physically force you, they want to coerce you financially and by leverage, by saying that you can't work or travel or shop without the vaccine. And of course, it'll be because they want you to stay safe, because they love you and care about you. But if you believe that, you'll believe anything. That's not why they want it. Now, Scott Morrison, who's the Prime Minister of Australia, he's the first one to come out openly and say, and I think he was testing the water, he said that they want to make the vaccine compulsory, mandatory in Australia. It produced a big backlash of opposition, and he's now backtracking a bit. But they run things up the flagpole to see how many people salute, you see. They try things out, see what happens. Do not imagine that they're going to forget about that. They want the vaccine mandatory. Now, I don't trust them at all, and I think I've given you some good reasons not to trust these people. I wouldn't buy a used car. I wouldn't buy anything off them. I don't trust them as far as I could throw them. And I certainly wouldn't let them stick baby DNA into me and microchips into me so they can see where I am and say, oh, thank you so much. No way. I will not let them do it. Now, I think also this whole vaccine thing, from our perspective and theirs, is a kind of a dummy run for the mark of the beast. Now, what will the mark of the beast be? A thing that shows your allegiance to the Antichrist. It gives you the right to buy and sell, and the absence of it takes away the right to buy and sell. Well, that's exactly what I think the vaccine will do. Okay, well, let's look at this thing of hysteria. How likely is it that God wants you to be hysterical or to listen to hysterical people? He doesn't. He wants you to stay calm. He wants you to make a decision to be calm and to reject and not listen to all people who are not calm. Hysteria never reflects God's character or his will, and it never reflects common sense or good judgment. Hysterical people will never give good advice or make good decisions. Do not be hysterical. Do not listen to hysteria. But another aspect of this, I think, which is telling, is that the government's argument is based on abandoning the individual for the sake of the wider society. You might think, oh, that's very right and proper. It's not the biblical way. A Christian cares for the one sheep that gets lost and goes out and leaves the 99, like God wants us to do. Leave the 99 and go and rescue this one sheep that is lost. A Christian crosses the road and helps the man who's been injured on his travels. God wants us to be concerned about individuals, because every individual is made in the image of God and has infinite value. He does not want us to negate or submerge or overlook or forget the value of the individual for the sake of whatever. No, that is not his way. Well, what about civil disobedience? I'm coming to an end now. Right, I see almost all churches at the moment are just passively complying. They're closed, there's no worship, there's no visiting of the sick, no visiting of the elderly, and I think the leaders, many leaders of churches, are secretly enjoying the time off, paid time off. They're not doing much, not doing anything. And they're certainly not put up much of a fight. John MacArthur being an honourable exception to this. He's sued the government, sued the governor about this, and won his case. But apart from him, what leaders are you seeing fighting this? I'm not accepting it. We meet, our church meets, we sing. I'm not going to let anybody tell me we can't worship. Who do they think they are to tell us we can't worship? Now, of course God tells us to obey rules, speed rules and drink driving rules and other rules and theft. And of course, all those rules are in accordance with his will. God wants us to obey governments because the things that they're doing, mostly, are good for us and right and proper. But he does not want us to obey them when they go against his will. Well, how do I know that God wants people to meet and to worship and to visit the sick and the elderly and so on? How do I know he wants that? Because he says so. He's commanded us to do all these things. Now, even James and Peter were told that they were not to worship and they were not to preach the gospel and so on. And they said, is it John and Peter? They said, well, you must do what you think right, but as for us, we can only do what we've been told to do. We're going to carry on. So they carried on. Now, they were disobeying the authorities. There is a time when you have to disobey the authorities. But what have they said also? This is dear to my heart. They won't let people go to the dying and be with them when they're dying. Now, this is very important. Many years ago, God laid it on me to go to the dying when they're dying, because it's their last chance to receive the gospel. And I have been and shared the gospel with many people who are dying. I don't believe it's me that makes them die. I think I go to them when they're dying. Now, you might think differently. But when I go to... I've been to many people who are dying and shared with them. And I believe that the hearing is the last thing to go. They can hear me. And I've shared the gospel with people lying there, even in comas, because it really matters to me to do it. and I believe some of them have been saved. Now, what the government have said is you can't go to them, not even your own family. You can't even go to your own parents as they die and be with them. And what I'm saying is, what kind of a bestial monster would make a rule like that? And the willingness to make it tells you a lot about them. Okay? And so the dying are left to die alone, uncomforted, abandoned, and for no need. This is not a dangerous virus. It is not necessary. So, I now therefore disobey the government when I think it's right to do so. I won't wear a mask. I don't wear one. I do sing in church extremely well. And I will not take a COVID vaccine. I'm not going to now or at any time. And I'd like to just finish by quoting John MacArthur. I've got a lot of time for him. And he said, when he was interviewed about his court case, he said, "This thing will not stop until we say, no, I'm not doing this anymore." And I thought that was a good way to put it. We in the church need to say, "No, I will not do this anymore," and take the consequences. Anyway, in my usual extremely brief way, I've gone through some of the highlights of this. I hope that helps. And but if you want more, look at the things I'm saying online, on Twitter, on Facebook, and so forth. Thank you.